Welcome to the Portion Podcast, a weekly discussion of the Torah portion of the week. I am your co-host, Aaron Roller, and I'm here with my co-host, Rabbi Jonathan Bienenfeld.
Good evening.
So, I don't know if you heard, but I made a small mistake when posting the Vayigash episode 2 weeks ago.
I'm so glad that you brought that up, because I was just horrified. What mistake are you referring to?
I think probably the one you're thinking of, which is that I accidentally clicked a box when I was posting the episode that said that it had explicit content.
Oh, I was being facetious, but yeah, that was pretty startling.
Did you notice that? Did anyone ask you about it?
Nobody asked me about it, but I noticed it, and I was wondering what either one of us had perhaps. I thought maybe that after we finished recording, you just kind of like stumbled back into the studio, like completely drunk, like
one
evening.
Overdubbed some things.
Yeah.
No. So if there are any listeners who were holding off on the Vayigash episode at the risk of offending their ears, rest assured, I think Rabbi, that you do use the word heretics, but there's really nothing stronger than that.
I think kids can and should hear the word heretics every now and again. You should not be the least bit concerned about playing that particular episode in the car with kids.
And if you were excited about it because you thought you were going to hear, I don't know what, I'm sorry to disappoint, but it was just an error on my part.
Pretty tame. Pretty tame.
As tame as we usually are. So anyway, here we are. We're in a new book of the Torah, and boy, things seem to have changed very quickly. Last time around, it was talking about the creation of the world and talking about one family and they're wandering around the desert, and now the story takes place. We're in an empire, and it's a nation. There's all these people around. It seems like it's a different book. That's really what it comes down to.
Different book, just a different spin on. I don't know that so much has changed in terms of the Jewish people themselves. I suppose there's been explosive population growth. That's something that the Torah documents at the beginning of this week's parsha. But I think what's most striking is that really not that much has changed, and yet everything has changed, which is really, you know, we've spoken about this a lot throughout Sefer Bereishit, about sort of the cyclical nature of Jewish history, and this is something that surely we've seen repeated again throughout the millennia that have followed, in that the Jewish people themselves may not have changed all that much, but the world around them had, and moreover the perception of the Jews changes, and sometimes changes so rapidly that you're just left without even being able to catch your breath, not knowing what had happened.
Well, to that point, so I mean the parsha and the book begins with a count off of the 12 tribes. They were 12 sons of Jacob last time, and now they've become their own, sort of each a tribe in their own right. And then we find out that they're gone, right? Joseph died, and they've all gone as well. And it really, I mean, I hate to sound either alarmist or drawing parallels too closely, but I can't help but read that, you know, one generation dies and kind of there's this immediate sea change, and not think about where we are today, where, again, you know, when you're stuck in a moment, it's sometimes hard to forget the context. It's hard to forget the anti-Semitism that may have existed in other moments, but it definitely feels like with every passing day, with more and more of the generation that survived the Holocaust passing, that anti-Semitism is rearing its ugly head in a way that it hadn't. I mean, I feel like every time maybe it's just that I'm on social media, but like, I feel like every time I am looking at Facebook or I'm looking at a newspaper, there's something else. And it really just brings to mind that we're really only talking about one generation. And yet a new king arose over Egypt who did not know of Joseph. He said to his people, and then this scheme comes about to enslave the Jews. What stands out to me is the gradual notion of this. Well, no. What really stands out is the lie. I mean, reading it literally, he says, "Hine am bnei Yisrael rav ve'atsum mimenu." The Jewish people, the children of Israel, are more numerous and stronger than we. I don't think that that's an accurate statement.
Well, I wonder if even within those words is mimenu qualifying both rav or just atsum? Is it that they are rav, they're numerous, v'atsum mimenu, and they are more powerful or more mighty than we are? Or is it that they are rav v'atsum mimenu, they're both more numerous and also more mighty?
Do you think it holds up either way? That, like, I mean,
I think it's possible, meaning it is feasible that even a smaller, it's at least feasible that a smaller population could somehow or another have proven themselves, I don't even want to say proven themselves, but just the perception becomes more understandable, meaning that if it's just a matter of taking a census, those are facts. You can prove that in some capacity or another. And maybe that exactly is the point, that even though it is so preposterous that the facts themselves don't even check out, that nevertheless somebody could make that sort of claim out of pure fear and xenophobia and also gain a following. I suppose that's possible, but it also may well be that the fact that they're numerous, they are numerous, that they are atsumi menu, that they are more powerful than we are, that lays really in the eye of the beholder, that despite the fact that it's a small population, that we view them, we see them as being very, very mighty, very robust, very influential, maybe very wealthy, very successful, who knows what kind of power they wield, speak languages that we don't necessarily, could perhaps create alliances with foreign enemies that we just can't to the same degree in at all. And it's like you start to feel the earth shifting beneath your feet when you look at these Jews out in Goshen.
So, okay, I want to just clarify here, because it sounds to me like I understand the question about the grammar was it modifying? Are they more than us, which seems very, very unlikely, because we're told there are 70 and even they have a boom. We're talking about an entire nation of Egypt. They're not saying that there are more Israelites than Egyptians at this point, but maybe mightier than us. But to me, that's completely, that's redolent of all the anti-Semitic tropes that we're used to. I remember hearing about a study where, and I think, I mean, I've done it myself actually, where when people, if I am talking to somebody, and this happened at work, not that I have encountered any anti-Semitism in the workplace, but if I get especially when I was working in New York City, there's a feeling like, oh, it's a Jewish holiday, everybody in the office is taken off, because there are a lot of Jews in New York City. But when I get the impression that someone thinks, oh, there are a lot of Jews out there, I'll say, well, how many Jews do you think there are? And the fact that there are 12 million Jews in the world, the fact that it's 2%, less than 2% of the U.S. population, and a fraction of a percent of the world population, just escapes people. So it's true to this day. I guess my point is, like, that idea, and then the idea that, like, oh, but you're so powerful. Like, it's not that it, I mean, it's not true. It isn't, you know, maybe there's an outsized influence given the numbers, but, like, I don't think it's a statement that is ever benign, and one that is usually, from the time it's said here in this week's Parsha until, like, literally today, it just never has any good intent.
Yeah, I don't know that it does. I don't know that it's, I don't want to come to the aid or rescue of the Egyptians too much.
That's good.
I just, you know, it's you could understand how that paranoia starts to build.
I mean, I guess you can understand it, but then, you know, but that doesn't,
I'm not saying that it's acceptable,
right?
I'm not saying that it's acceptable,
and then it goes and then, you know, where the way I read it, the way it speaks to me is, you know, that we go directly from this statement, which is, I'm going to assume, factually untrue, to Hava nilchak malo, let's outsmart them, pen yirbe, lest they increase more, v'haya tikra ena milchama, and if there comes a war, v'nosaf gam hu also nenu, they're going to ally with our enemies. Why would you assume that these people who are, number one, you're saying that they're not regular Egyptians, there's this claim of dual loyalty, which Jews have always been subject to, they're not patriotic Egyptians, And not only are they not normal Egyptians, they're such abnormal Egyptians that they would ally with our enemies if there's a war. I mean, like, it's so to me, the line from lying about the strength and influence of the Israelites to sowing the seeds of enmity and paranoia to moving on to persecution and oppression, it's such a straight line, and it's unfortunately a line which I think we are seeing in the world today, and unfortunately not just about the Jewish people. So I don't know. Do you obviously that's one reading of it, but do you not agree with that reading?
I agree with the reading. I just wonder if it's untrue.
Maybe it's wrong.
No, meaning I think your reading is right. I wonder if, meaning, are these concerns? I don't know that these concerns are less than genuine or less than accurate.
No, I think anti-Semites are really concerned about Jews.
Wait, I'm sorry, what do you mean?
I agree, the concerns are real.
let me clarify then. Meaning to say that the fact of the matter is you have this Egyptian population that's looking out upon this other population that specifically does not live amongst the rest of the people, specifically lives in Goshen, seemingly. There are different, you know, rabbinic traditions about perhaps that really not being the case, and that whereas this had started off really as a nation that was living completely set apart in Goshen, that they had started to move closer and closer into sort of the mainstream of Egyptian society. But you have this people that's decidedly different. They classify themselves differently. They consider themselves to be a family nation sort of people. They are becoming more and more numerous. They're becoming more and more powerful, more and more influential, more and more wealthy. And this is an empire that does have concerns about incoming foreign armies and the like. And I guess I know it's really taboo, and I know it's something that the for a long time, the question of dual loyalty was preposterous because there's nothing else, no other entity to be loyal to. The idea of the land of Israel was so hazy and so amorphous that it was this very conceptual, yeah, we have a relationship with the land of Israel. We hope that the Messiah will come and whisk us away and usher in this era of world peace, but then everybody's going to be totally cool with it. And it's only within the last 70 years that it's been an actual and really genuine question. And I guess I know it's the elephant in the room, but is it wrong? Do we not have, you can't talk about dual loyalty because God forbid, of course you don't have dual loyalty. Is that true? Is that true that we don't have, dual loyalty, or that theoretically at some point that can become a, that we could arrive at some sort of impasse where, well, which country are you more loyal to? The one in which you happen to live, or the one that you consider to be your historical home, your national home, and your ultimate destiny?
I think that I don't want to take us too far from the Parsha. I think we could probably spend all of our time discussing this issue, but I think that I do think it's an unfair question. I think that it certainly goes without saying that we pray towards Jerusalem. We hope for we hope for the restoration of Israel, of Zion. I mean, these are ideas which have been part of who the Jewish people are, what the Jewish people are for centuries and millennia. But at the same time, I don't think that there is, I mean, you know, and I don't know how large the anti-Semitic population of the portion of listeners is. Maybe someone would come forward with a list of Jewish spies or people who betrayed their countries. But I don't think that there's anything throughout Jewish history to ever, in any significant way, question the fact that the Jewish people living in a certain country are generally loyal citizens and just as loyal as any other citizen of that country, notwithstanding how they pray and where they're, that there's a very, very large place in our heart. I think that those two things can exist can coexist. I think that history shows that they coexist. I think even within the last 70 years with the establishment of the state of Israel, they exist. I think to you know, get a little bit more argumentative about it, I think that if anything, it's, you know, what having the state of Israel has done is show is give an alternative when it goes the other way. I mean, if we see the, you know, I think something, some very, very large percentage of French Jewry has migrated to this, to Israel in the last 10, 15 years with the growth of anti-Semitism there. But I don't think it's because the French Jews gave up on France. I think it's, I think all of a sudden they didn't feel welcomed as French citizens.
What about when Americans moved to Israel?
I don't think it's because they, that I have more direct experience with, and I don't know any Americans who say, I don't love America, or I don't, you know, they have a desire to live there, but it's not out of a lack of gratitude or feeling of,
no, not lack,
not
of
even gratitude, even,
yeah,
not, or feeling of gratitude, or even feeling, I mean, maybe there's certain, you know,
I just think it's sort of like, you know, like America's, you know, served its purpose, and now, you know, sort of take it or leave it. It's not my, I don't know. I think for people who have left, it was great. Right. And America was very good to me. It was good to my family, but you know, like, I'm moving on to what is really more,
I definitely recognize wanting to have wanting your children to live and to be Israeli and not American, but at the same time I think that the claim of dual loyalty, I even Americans who've made Aliyah, I don't think you would claim that they are disloyal. I as Americans, I think it's, like you said,
disloyal.
It's
I guess,
a state.
Right. I guess just move.
And actually, can I can sort of take it back to the Parsha that I didn't know the conversation was going to go in this way. I would have come more prepared for this, but I definitely heard Drusha. I don't know if it's in a classic rabbinic statement. I think it's the explanation of not to go back to Egypt, right? There's a commandment not to go back to Egypt.
Right.
I've read the suggestion that the sort of the way that's been emphasized is to prevent what might have otherwise naturally been a sense of appreciation, even with the slavery. Like, the way that the United States and England have their quote-unquote special relationship, despite the fact that the U.S., rebelled against and split off from the United Kingdom, same that it could have been the same way, that the Jewish people might have, like, had a very, they're right next door to each other, so they might have had a very strong cultural exchange, and Israel would have felt culturally indebted and connected to and have special relationship with the Egyptians after enough time had passed, and yet the Torah says, no, don't do that. Like, that to sort of fight against the fact that there is maybe a tendency,
sort of,
even in the
right,
case of,
I mean,
Egypt.
I believe it's the Ramban in Parshas Shoftim, right?
I'm so glad you're here to
about not institutionalizing that degree of almost collaboration, or, like you said, indebtedness, that because there's you know, a current of, let's say, you know, goods and natural resources coming out of Egypt towards Israel, so that could be very, very problematic, being in Egypt's debt is what the Torah may be prohibiting.
These are complicated questions, and it is a jam-packed parsha.
Yeah,
so we should.
I just want to
move on.
The one thing that I wanted to come back to, at least on this week's parsha, is that effectively, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I don't know that I blame the Egyptians for their concerns. I'm not sure that they're not valid concerns. I think where Egypt is to blame is the way that they respond, the way that they react, and that at no point, right, we go from this, it seems like this very small group in this closed room, you know, Pharaoh talking to whomever he is. Maybe it's a large pep rally and he's just
it's a Nuremberg rally.
Yeah, and he's just, you know, riling up the masses and he's, you know, whipping them all into a frenzy. I don't know, but at no point is there ever any, you know, ambassador or figurehead from the Jewish community who's invited in for a conversation. Tell us about you. What's going on? What's the story? These are our concerns. These are our perceptions of you. Are we right to feel this way, or are we not right to feel this way? And I understand that degree of, you know, civility and conversation is totally anachronistic and was not the sort of thing that, that ever would have happened. But that's a problem. That's a problem. It's anachronistic only because the Jewish mode of life and the sort of decency and values that the Torah emphasizes hadn't yet impacted and hadn't yet been absorbed into mainstream society the way that they very much are today at least in the West, really in the entire planet. But that's, I think, where the fault lies. That how do you go from suspicion to oppression without a conversation in between?
I don't know. I mean, I think at the point, like, they're probably at the point you wake up, the conversation is, it's too late to have the conversation. I don't know. I think these are, it's very loaded conversation we've stumbled upon here, but there's so many things to talk about here. I want to get deeper into it, where we're all of a sudden the Israelites, the Jewish people have been enslaved, and it goes worse beyond slavery to actual genocide, where the command comes to for the midwives to kill any male child. And we have a phenomenal example of civil disobedience, where these midwives rebel and don't listen. And there's a question about there's a very strong midrashic tradition that these midwives are, who are called Shifra and Pua, that their other names are Yocheved and Miriam, that they're Moshe's mother and sister, so that they're Jewish midwives
and sort of leaders of the people, the family, the nation, whatever it is, that they're far more prominent than at least their pseudonyms would lead you to believe.
Right, and the other alternative is that they're actually Egyptian women, because that's not to deny or undermine the prevailing midrashic tradition, but logically speaking, it's also very hard to imagine telling these Jewish women to kill the Jewish babies. Either way, they take a very courageous stance, and as the husband of a midwife, I certainly feel a sense of pride. I would also note that being the husband of a midwife does not make you a mid-husband by extension.
I'm pretty sure it does.
No, so midwife is a coming from the German like mid, or Yiddish, like mit is to be with. So the midwife is with the wife when she's having the baby. So I'm the husband of a midwife should actually be a mid-midwife, if anything. But I just prefer to not talk about it so much.
Sounds like another Facebook poll.
No. Anyway, we get the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu, and it's worth thinking about that the Moshe is born in this first parsha of the book of Exodus, and he dies in the last parsha of Sefer Dvarim, the last book of the Torah, and so the rest of the Torah is basically coterminous with Moshe's life. Now, it's not all story, but it's just interesting to think that one level of the rest of the Torah is essentially Moshe's life story. And that's one perspective to look at all of this right here. That said, though, we get a lot of people who don't even have any names in this week's parsha, which is really interesting because the English is Exodus, or I guess it's the Greek, but really, it's the Hebrew for Shemot is the Hebrew name is Shemot, and the actual translation of Shemot is names, the book of names. And yet, in this week's portion, there are a lot of people who sort of go nameless, including Moshe's parents. It actually just talks about their tribes, and it says a man from the tribe of Levi goes and marries a woman from the tribe of Levi. It talks about Paro's daughter. It doesn't say her name. It just calls her Bat Paro, daughter of Paro. It talks about Moshe's sister, who we know later is introduced as Miriam, but it just says his sister went to watch what was going to happen. So why do you think, what do you read into the fact that there are so many people who are introduced to us without any names?
So I think it goes hand in hand with the fact that, you know, this effectively begins the story of how the Jew, well, it's Exodus, right? How the Jews emerge from slavery and oppression to redemption and freedom, right? Liberation. And the way that they get there is not, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't need to be through people who have any specific or special sort of pedigree. That sometimes the difference makers become people who are just sort of going about their business, but have their moral compasses adjusted and calibrated properly. And I come back to, and you mentioned it, that, and I really saw that interpretation from from Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who actually reads it into the words of the pasuk, that the midwives are referred to as miyaladota ivriot, right? Which it's a very astute observation, that could mean miyaladot are midwives, ha ivriot are Hebrew, so meaning they could be Hebrew midwives, they could also be midwives to the Hebrews. And I think the point is true either way, and I don't think that it clashes really, really with the rabbinic interpretation that indeed these people were Yocheved and Miriam. But I think that that's something that the Torah is specifically trying to cloak a little bit, meaning that it didn't need to be. You're going to know exactly who Yocheved is. You're going to know exactly who Miriam is. They're very prominent. We know about them. They're going to feature prominently in the story throughout the entire, or at least Miriam throughout the entire the entire 40 years in the wilderness until her death, and the well of Miriam, and how she was she was a leader, and she was a prophetess, and all of that. But it didn't need to be the case. Meaning, in this act, it could have been anyone. It was just a simple act of doing the right thing. Maybe she was Jewish. Maybe she even wasn't. Maybe she was a Hebrew midwife. Maybe she was a midwife, meaning an Egyptian midwife, to the Hebrews. We don't need to know who Yocheved and who Amram, meaning Moshe's parents, were. There's so much that's just unclear and murky, because all these people just as easily could have been the regular average Joe. And it's sort of the leadership, or at least the action of those kinds of individuals who don't necessarily have any big and highfalutin sort of positions, who actually can be the difference makers in terms of moving this entire narrative, moving the entire story forward towards a place of ultimate redemption.
And that theme of doing the right thing, of going the extra mile, comes to the fore as Moshe grows up. Before we just get to that, it strikes me as so strange. I mean, there's something so, from a narrative standpoint, it's very classic, the idea that Moshe grows up in Paro's own house. The idea that, like, just as background, there's this Midrashic tradition that, it's not clear on the face of it why they're killing all of the males. And so the Midrashic tradition is that the Pharaoh has this prediction that he's going to be brought down by one of the Israelite men. And so that's what leads to this. And so the idea then that the figure of his destruction is growing up in his own house.
Right beneath his nose.
Right. So that there's the irony there. But how does that are you aware of any explanation of how that actually happens, how that's allowed to happen, when his daughter shows up with a baby that she finds, and she says straight up, this is one of the Hebrew children. So she knows. It's not a mistake on her part, and she seeks a Hebrew woman. She actually says, go find the baby's mother to nurse the child. So there's no confusion on the part of Pharaoh's daughter, who certainly is doing the humane and merciful and heroic thing in not letting this child drown in the Nile. But, like, is there any midrashic or commentary that talks about how Moshe is allowed to even grow up in the house of
the past? Not that I know of, and I know that this is going to sound, like, totally unsophisticated, but, you know, fathers have soft spots for their daughters, and, you know, when their daughters come while, you know, doe-eyed into the room and say, oh, you know, look what I found. You know, can I keep it? You know, I told you 1,000 times that you can't have a cat. You know, I'm allergic to cats, and there's no way I'm letting this thing in the head. But then, oh, here she comes, and she looks so, you know, sweet, and she, meaning, And as much as that sounds maybe, like I said, really just unsophisticated, I do think that there's something very powerful about that. Meaning to say that we have this vision of a pharaoh who's just totally ruthless and totally brutal to the point of savagery, where he's more than willing to issue this edict of a wholesale infanticide against the Jewish people, have their kids thrown into the Nile, and then my sweet kid wants something, and sort of I'll allow for it. You know, there are countless stories of just vicious, nasty Nazi war criminals who had pets and groomed their pets and couldn't bear the thought or the sight of a dog's paw becoming, you know, caught in whatever, and at the same time could commit genocide against actual people and could throw completely innocent babies into a pit. And you wonder if maybe this is, like, you're starting to see this totally absurdly bifurcated personality of power, that on the one hand he's totally ruthless, he's just a nasty monster of a, can't even say human being, and on the other hand he has this, you know, my daughter, my sweet daughter, whatever you want, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think Hitler was a vegetarian, actually.
Is that true?
I believe it is, yeah.
For what reason? For that reason?
Yeah, animal rights.
Wow.
It's really crazy, if true. But that's that contrast of that kind of perverse distinction or perverse double standard, I think, stands in such great contrast to the oft remarked upon moral evolution that we see. It's not an evolution; it's just sort of the way we see as readers, essentially, seeing Moshe's moral sensibilities, right? That we begin. So, for those not reading along, the text, it's almost like masterful from a storytelling perspective, where we get kind of the overview of where they are, and then the slavery, and then the decree to kill the firstborn, and then we kind of zoom in on the specific family and the child who's the mother puts him on a little raft in the Nile, and he's found by the princess, and then it jumps forward in time, and now he's a young man, and now we're with Moshe. He's grown up, and we get him first. He sees an Egyptian beating an Israelite, and he kills the Egyptian. He stops him from abusing this slave, and that's a very clear example where he's favoring the underdog. There's a clear oppressor, there's a clear victim, and he makes the call and sides with his own people. He knows that he's a Jew, and that's where he stands. And we move from there very quickly to the next day, it sounds like, or immediately thereafter, he sees two Jewish slaves fighting, and he tries to break up the fight. And so it's not as clear there who the oppressor is and who's the victim. And yet he still gets involved, even when it's less clear. And then he has to kind of go on the run because Pharaoh finds out that he killed the Egyptian. And then he's at the well in Midian, and, you know, the famous well, which is where you go to meet people to get married. It's the watering hole. And he helps the daughters of Yitro, the high priest of Midian. He helps these daughters who are getting harassed by the local shepherds, and these are total strangers, and he still gets involved. So, I mean, that's, again, it's a famous interpretation. Certainly I was taught, is that in the, I don't know, which is that a parish that talks about that, or it's more modern.
These three episodes are maybe
Rav Hirsch. I feel like it's more modern, but like still very like old and established.
Not familiar.
Oh, you never heard that before?
I don't know if I've heard. I certainly don't know the source. I don't know that I've ever.
I remember
heard as this sort of this escalation in that sort of capacity,
or that the clarity or the cause it has less and less to do with him, and he still decides to take a stand every single time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's in.
By the way, just to cap that off. Right, what's the fourth incident, and this really comes more from the Medrash, but immediately before the actual burning bush, well-known rabbinic tradition that what brought Moshe to that particular point, really at Har Sinai, where he sees the burning bush, was that one of his sheep has sort of wandered off, and he realized that it had really just gone to find a little brook, and it was thirsty. He said, "Oh, you're thirsty, you know, poor sheep." And he actually lifts the sheep up onto his shoulder and carries it back. And that when God sees that, right, this act of sensitivity towards this animal, he says that, you know, if this is the way that he treats actual sheep, then all the more so how he'll treat, you know, my sheep that I shepherd. So meaning maybe even another step removed, in that it's no longer even a human being, but that Moshe's compassion and sensitivity knows no bounds.
So it's really in stark contrast, certainly in stark contrast to Hitler being a vegetarian, but also to the Pharaoh making this distinction of like, oh, I'll be nice to this one, but I'm murdering everybody else. Like he's really sensitive and stands up for the rights of whoever's being oppressed or whoever needs help across the board. And that's the characteristic that the Torah is exemplifying in him as a leader. And it's worth saying, we're going to probably have many occasions to talk about it, how he is. Maybe there's aspects where what I'm saying is not correct, but we spent so much time in Genesis speaking about the archetypes and the idea of Masa Avot Siman Labanim, that what the patriarchs do becomes a signpost or signals or becomes archetypical for the children. Moshe, in so many ways, he's a role model, but he is unprecedented. He kind of stands alone in a lot of ways, right? He doesn't become a model for a high priest. He doesn't become a model for the Jewish kingship. His own lineage is kind of, we don't know who his children are, who his children become. He is just exceptional. He's really an exceptional, exceptional leader. I mean, we say it in the prayer, the song Yigdal. We say, Lo kam b'Yisrael kamo she'od, that there will never be another one like Moshe. He's really just such a very, the Avot were very special in terms of being those archetypes for us, but he's special in a different way of being almost
special. He's not really he cannot even serve as a model for our own behavior the way that the patriarchs and matriarchs are, right? Moshe famously, and we'll get to this later on, but famously he effectively dissolves his own family, divorces his wife because he needs to be at the beck and call of God constantly for this ongoing prophecy that takes up his entire life that we now call the Torah, which is obviously important, goes without saying, but made it impossible for him to engage in the sorts of things that we consider necessary, obligatory, part and parcel of our divine service, creates the contours of our religious life is family life. And Moshe pivots away from family life for the sake of a higher calling, and it would be incorrect for anybody else to say, well, you know, I want to be just like Moshe Rabbeinu, so therefore I'm going to, you know, live the life of a hermit, and I'll go hang out, you know, in the synagogue all day long,
or the desert,
or the desert, or outside of the whatever it is, you know, wherever it is that I'm most likely to receive my version of prophecy. That would be incorrect, and we need to recognize exceptional, unique that Moshe Rabbeinu was. He's therefore, and I think that's important. It's important on both levels, both appreciating just how extraordinary his life really was, but also not making the mistake of believing that we can then use it to pattern our own lives after his,
or to pattern everything in our, you know, there's certain things we can learn, but certain ways he's like the exception that proves the rule in certain things.
Right.
So one thing that struck me, so this is him withdrawing from his marriage is something which happens years in the future. In the meantime, now he's an eligible bachelor at the well in Midian, and he famously marries the daughter, Tzipora, daughter of Yitro, the priest of Midian. And something that struck me this year, now I will say this also runs counter. There's an idea that Yitro was kind of on the outs, that he had tried the patience of his flock. He had a mega church in Midian, but he kept changing gods on them. He kept trying new things. He was a theological radical, always trying to find the right God, and he'd finally gotten to he'd finally chanced upon monotheism, but at that point he'd already alienated everybody and he was on the outs. But that's one tradition of Medrash. Certainly on the surface of the text, the idea that he is he's got this very high title, and I wondered about his daughters doing this. Like, couldn't he have gotten some member of his flock to go draw water for him? Or does he have a servant? Does he have somebody who can do this for him? The idea that he, you know, has his daughters doing, like, they're pretty down to earth people, I guess. And it's then you really see this when they come back and they say, oh, this Egyptian man helped us out. And he says, well, why don't you invite him back over? It's just worth. I never really thought about kind of like what made Moshe and Tzipora, or the women of Yitro's family, made them good candidates to marry Moshe. But this year, reading the parsha, it just kind of struck me that these are this must have been a very special family, the Yitro family.
And Yitro clan.
Where is his wife? She's out of the picture
in the tent.
Maybe. I don't know. You'd think that there's. I've never heard anything about Tzipora's mother, Yitro's wife.
Yeah, nothing comes to mind.
No medrash. No, it's I wonder what that's all about. Anyway, then we get the burning bush. Moshe's, he's married. He's tending the flocks of his father-in-law, and he encounters God. This is this happens on Har Horev, and there he encounters God, and he hears a voice telling him to take off his shoes. And this made me wonder, why don't we take our shoes off when we pray? Is this another example of what we were just talking about, how we don't actually learn certain things from Moshe?
Well, I think it's more that we don't presume. They did take shoes off when they performed the service in the actual Beit HaMikdash in the temple.
With the synagogue, which we call the Mikdash Ma'at, the mini temple.
We don't presume has the same degree of sanctity, certainly as a place where, you know, this is God's divine presence manifest. At least seemingly. It's sort of telling, and it's also sort of odd. The Torah makes it very, very clear that God himself was not in the burning bush. Right? That would be theologically, that would be problematic. Right, it says that the angel was inside of God. Sent an angel inside of the bush. But either way, this is.
But that God then chooses to speak to Moshe.
God uses this as sort of a platform to be able to communicate with a human being, and somehow or another, this is an expression of His will. It's a reflection of His presence, whatever exactly Shekhinah might mean, and therefore it becomes hallowed ground.
In India, they take their shoes off when they go into shul.
Well, that changes everything.
It's just interesting because I heard. I did get to go and daven at the shul in Cochin where they take their shoes off. But I subsequently heard a radio feature on the Jewish community in India, and where they kind of took umbrage at the suggestion that they had been influenced by the local Muslim population. Muslims do take their shoes off when they go to pray. Mm-hmm. They turned it around and said, no, we get it from Moshe in this week's Parsha. And Islam, of course, developed after. They learned it from us.
They got it from us, interesting.
Which is, although it's, certainly not the, certainly not the, not our custom.
I think this might cut to, and you mentioned it, that maybe this is one of the sort of unique dimensions of Moshe. I think in all likelihood, I think this speaks more to the fact that this was hallowed ground, right? That's what God actually tells him. But what is interesting is that the manner in which Moshe sort of differentiates himself from other prophets, and this is spoken about in more mystical, Kabbalistic kinds of literature, as sort of comparing and contrasting the lens through which any given prophet can actually view God, right? When he engages in prophecy, how does he actually perceive of God, or the imagery that God is showing him? And we say that whereas everybody views views God in the prophetic moment through sort of a clouded lens, it becomes impossible to really perceive of God clearly. We say that Moshe is still viewing God through a lens. It's not direct, but it's what we call the aspaklaria hameira, which also sounds so beautiful, which is just the crystal clear lens. And it's almost like there are no borders, there are no boundaries, that Moshe connects more directly with God in a manner that other prophets, both before and after him, are never capable of doing. And it's interesting that here in this first encounter, God says, remove a barrier, or remove something that otherwise serves as a barrier between yourself and the moment, yourself and this experience, your actual physical body and the ground upon which you stand. Remove that. Shal na'alecha me'al raglecha. You have to remove the shoes from upon your feet so you can more almost dig in or connect with this piece of real estate that has become so replete with my holiness.
With all that, something that is striking, certainly very clear in the text is how reluctant Moshe is. He really is a reluctant prophet, and he tries to bow out multiple ways. He says, I'm not a great speaker, and you know, God's got this great response. Like, who do you think is putting words in people's mouths to begin with? I'm kind of controlling all the things. And he says, well, let somebody who's more traditional messenger, a more well-known leader go. They're not going to believe me. He comes up with all these reasons why it shouldn't be him. And he seems certainly very reluctant, maybe very daunted by what it's going to be. Do you see that as a sign of leadership, the fact that there's a humility and a reluctance there, a lack of ego, or is it a flaw?
I mean, the answer ultimately is yes to all of the above, only because we see that Moshe at some point is really rebuked for just how persistent he is. But it seems that, at least initially, that this is really the appropriate response. We know that Moshe is, and it's so... there's so much to say about this, just this point itself, but that Moshe is lauded for his humility.
Big time.
Right. Now, who writes all those compliments? Moshe. Right? Then Moshe is the one who's later on going to be forced into this very awkward position of needing to write in, I think it's in Parsha Shlach, I think it is, where he is... that he is the most humble person who you know, just ever was around at the time, just a paragon of humility. It's a very strange thing to write about yourself and still maintain your humility. A lot to be learned about humility from that reality. But at any rate, it's a wonderful quality. Right? Show me the person who believes that he is prepared or he is worthy of being the Messiah. And I'll show you a person who should quite clearly be out of the running. The last person I want as the savior is one who says, "Don't worry, I got this." I would run for the hills as soon as somebody like that showed himself. So the fact that Moshe recognizes just how enormous a task this is, what he's being tasked with, what he's being told to actually go and do. It's just to serve as God's mouthpiece, to serve as God's ambassador, to speak on God's behalf with the most powerful person on the planet, and that historically, not doubting that this is not possible or that it's not going to happen, more that of course it's going to happen, but that he should be the focal point of, like you said, right, the Torah makes Judaism, the Torah makes society. Without Torah, the world, all of humanity is so steeped in darkness that we insist as a matter of tradition that the world never would have been allowed to continue or perpetuate if not for the acceptance of the Torah. The Torah has completely changed the landscape of all of society, all of humanity. And as you said before, and I think it's true, on one very real wavelength, the Torah is effectively the biography of Moshe Rabbeinu. Right, we have one long introductory chapter that deals with his predecessors or his ancestors, but it's effectively the life and times of Moshe Rabbeinu. And that is just an enormous, enormous pair of shoes to have to fill.
Or take off.
Or, I knew that was coming.
You walked right into it. You really stepped in it.
Ah! And that gives him pause, and well, it should. Well, should anybody...
You should have been waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Are we doing this right now?
No, I'm done.
So it's just too massive. It's just too huge for him. And I think that so the answer is yes. It's all true. On the one hand, his humility, his reluctance is absolutely well placed. It's exactly how it should be. On the other hand, it seems that at some point, God's telling you, I know you think you're the wrong man for the job. And all signs point to you being the wrong man for the job. Every item that you've thrown back at me saying that it should be somebody else, they're all true. It's all correct. Don't worry about it. I got a plan anyway. And at some point, apparently it became sort of a doubting of either God's ability or God's having it all worked out already, or perhaps doubting the wherewithal of the Jewish people or of the faith and the ability of the Jewish people. At some point, it sort of spills over, crosses that line, and that's where God actually becomes upset. But initially, yes, this is exactly the kind of person that you want to lead the Jewish people out of Egypt.
So he goes back to Egypt to fulfill his mission, and he gets the support of the Jewish people. I mean, there's so much to say about all these things and the way he proves himself to them and all that, but what's really notable, and we alluded to this when we talked about whether or not this was the greatest cliffhanger in the Torah, and you were thoroughly voted down on that one. But
was that up?
Yeah, nobody voted for you.
Oh man!
I really think that the leading into from Miketz to Vayigash is a better cliffhanger. But this is a phenomenal ending to the parsha. Also, it's a clear second, but it's clearly second, and I think. But the point is that
it's first. It's first.
Okay, but the it's so strange, or not that it's strange, but like, what does it mean that he fails? God says you're gonna say this thing, and God knows that Pharaoh is going to refuse, and it's not going to be successful, and it gets worse. It gets worse before the fact that it's going to get worse before it gets better. What does that prove? What is that about? And I have a question, and I didn't have time to really research this, but am I wrong that God says tell Pharaoh to free them, and then Moshe goes with his brother with the elders, and they say we want to go into the desert to celebrate for 3 days? Are they not fulfilling the mission correct? Like is that ever interpreted as being falling short of what they were supposed to do?
I don't think so. I mean, we've spoken about this. I forget the exact examples, but this becomes a recurring theme that knowing even when dialogue or conversation seems clear, it's so terse and it's so clipped that it's difficult to know exactly what's ever said and what's not. It seems that I don't believe that there's any sense that somehow
that they said
another,
the wrong thing.
Yeah, I don't think that like. You know, you're sort of standing. You know, it's like when you're asking for a raise, right? You have a certain number in your head, and then you're sitting across from everybody, and they're, oh, you know, the boss looks pretty angry today. I was gonna ask for a $10,000 raise, but you look at you, so about five.
Right, but that could be when it's God telling you to ask for the raise. That could be, but okay, we'll take that off the table though, because there's no indication. The text seems to vary, but there's no indication that God. I mean,
that Moshe falls short of what he was
right.
Otherwise
he's not being chastised for it, but so taking that off the table, what's the significance of it getting worse before it gets better? Like, what does that mean? God, like your point about it being a cliffhanger. I mean, it does end on this great note, where again, I don't think of it as a cliffhanger because it's not like I don't think you're left wondering what's going to happen. It's more that it's about to happen, right? Literally. The last...
Oh, so
the last,
I lost on a technicality is what you're telling me.
I just think it's not classified
as a cliffhanger.
I don't think... Okay, listen, I don't want to... I'm not going to hear the end of this. No, but to be fair, not as many people voted. The consensus was very clear, but it was fewer voters on that Facebook poll. But the last pasuk, the last verse says, because Moshe is questioning this. He says, "My Lord, why have you harmed this people? Why have you sent me?" Because Pharaoh made things worse. "From the time I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he harmed his people, but you did not rescue your people." And Hashem says, "Atatira asher esel Pharaoh."
Oh, I am just getting warmed up.
"Kiviyad chazakai yeshalchem uviyad chazakai yegar shem me'artso." "Now you will see what I shall do to Pharaoh, for through a strong hand will he send them out, and through a strong hand will he drive them from his land." So it's like God's setting. I mean, there's a lot of setting Pharaoh up here, but it's just, it's really, but here it really impacts the Jewish people, right? Pharaoh says, "Oh, you want to leave? Let me make your workload even higher, even harder." And I don't know, what you make of it.
So look, on the most basic level, I don't know, right? And I think that's an important answer, meaning that we cannot presume that Jewish history is ever going to move in a straight line. We cannot presume that once the redemption is at hand, and I think this is an incredibly important lesson for today. You know, not every backtracking and not every wrong move and not every hiccup in what we certainly hope, at least, is going to continue to blossom into the full and final redemption, namely that the Jewish people have been back in their land for the past 70 years under their own autonomy. That not every hiccup in that process necessarily indicates that we were wrong. No, it's not really good. It's not really happening. We're not actually en route. We may well be en route, but that's just not how things go. Sometimes you do take a step, and I don't know that this is that things have gotten so much worse before they've gotten better. I think this is more we tend to have this sense of progress as looking like a perfectly straight, diagonal line that cuts between, the X and the Y axis and just continues to grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. That's not how it works. Like, you look at any given stock that does well over a 12-month period. If you look at a graph that shows the full 12 months, so it effectively moves in that straight line. But the reality is that when you sort of zoom in, you see bumps along the way. Yeah, it was up today, and then it was down, and then it was down a little more, and then it went up, and then it shot up, and then it went down a little more. And it's sort of over they're in far better position now, even with the extra workload, than they were just a short while ago, right? We know that because they have Moshe Rabbeinu. Right, and we know that because they have Aaron. We know that because everything is already starting to go. What's difficult for Moshe to see, what's difficult is for Moshe himself to see that. Right, having said that, I'm clearly the wrong person for the job, and this was something that he just didn't expect. But I think that lesson number one is that you just never know. We cannot presume that Jewish history or that our lives, that our national growth, our national development, our personal growth, our personal development is ever going to move in a completely straight line. There are going to be hiccups. There are going to be difficulties along the way. Why they happen, we don't know. They're tests of some sort, testing our resilience and our perseverance, and persevere we must. But I think on another level, it's interesting that sort of in the midst of the parsha, there is this short little throwaway right before the burning bush that the Jewish people called out to God, and that he heard their outcry. That there was a new king, and he oppressed them even more, and then there was an outcry, and then God listened to them. So what changed is that when things get really, really, really bad, there is a certain sense of almost abandonment of one's own ability to get himself out of that mess. And I think that's a critically important part of redemption. Right? We believe in our own agency. We believe in our ability to... We believe that God has given us a great ability to do. But we also recognize that behind it all, without God's help and without God's determination that things should move in a positive sort of direction, that we're completely feeble or completely incapable of doing anything. And it's when that realization becomes, not just sort of something that we pay tribute to in the backs of our minds, but becomes really crystallized that I need God here and only God can really help me out of this mess. That's when it seems that redemption or the the process of redemption really becomes triggered.
And so with that, wait till you see what happens next week. That's kind of where God leaves it, and that's we can't do any better than that.
So. Greatest cliffhanger ever.
The Portion Podcast is recorded in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, produced by Aaron Roller. Our theme music is The Magid's Niggin by Simply Tzfat. If you enjoy the show, please tell your friends about it any way you can. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you get podcasts. Don't forget to rate us and leave a review. And you can follow the show on Facebook. Have a good Shabbos, and remember,
there is always more to learn.